Yeah, Center for Human Services and Rural Health Policy to order, please. Welcome again, those of you who were here last time and came back. I have a list of people to sign, signed up. Jennifer Crowder, or Louder. Jennifer, are you? Yeah. Jerry, did you want to come up?
Sure. Oh, he wants to be on the whole time?
Kathy Clausen.
Too.
Where? Oh.
I just found out.
Oh. Jennifer.
Hi.
Would you like to introduce yourself, please?
My name is Jennifer Lauer. I am a patient in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program along with my fiance. When he
now, where do you live, by the way?
We live in Kaiser.
Kaiser. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that when my fiance first got in the program, we had a really hard time finding a grower, and I looked in the newspaper. I found an ad that said medicinal growers. It was about hydroponics and whatnot. So I called the number. And
thank you.
I wasn't sure what I could say and what I couldn't say. We were brand new to the program. So I just kind of told him what we were doing. We were looking for a grower and whatnot. And this person said he would like to do that, and pretty much told us we would get 1 ounce a month. We would pay $100 for anything above that that we needed, and per ounce, $100 per ounce. And it just sounded really fishy. So, you know, we had problems right from the get-go until I came across the Stormberry Cardholders Foundation. They helped network with other patients to help us get medicine. They helped us get our garden started, and the programs really worked for us. So,
okay. So how did you find the first person that you went to? How did you find that?
I actually looked in the nickel ads.
And what was the ad that you...
It said medicinal growers, hydroponics, you know, questions. And they sold material. There was a store. He ran a store. And then I guess him and his other half, they were cardholders as well. They were growing for themselves. And he said he was trying to get a couple other people together so he could get a bigger garden started. And it just all didn't sound right.
So he asked for... $100 for an ounce, is that what it was?
What he said was he would give us 1 ounce per month, and then if we needed any other medicine above
I see. Oh,
then we would
pay
$100 per ounce.
Yeah, okay.
So, and I know the plants produce a lot more medicine than that, so.
Yeah. Well, and under the law, the medicine belongs to you.
Right.
The plants.
Right. That's why we thought, you know, this doesn't sound like a good idea. So we never went through with that and just kind of had the card and wasn't able to do anything with it.
Okay.
So we weren't quite sure how to get started.
Okay. Good.
So the Stormy Rays Cardholders Foundation helped us do that.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Would you
Thank
like
you.
To introduce yourself?
I'm Kathy. I'm a cardholder.
Kathy, give
me a second. Born and raised here in Salem,
okay.
And I'm a firm believer in the medical marijuana program. I have excruciating pain in my right leg. I've had an accident when I was 17,
mm-hmm.
And I get a pinched nerve in my back, so it helps me immensely with the pain. I cannot take pain pills because they don't stay down, but I'm one of the ones that... I've been on the program for a year, and I'm having great difficulty hooking up with somebody to help me. I live in subsidized housing, so I cannot grow it myself. And I have more or less been abused trying to hook up with somebody to be my care provider. I'm also on disability and on limited income. And I do, and my doctor says this medicine is really working good for me. And I believe it myself. And I've been to other organizations, you know, regarding the medical marijuana programs. And I get confused at some of them because you hear this and then you hear that, so you don't know what to think. And I just don't want to break the law. I just want to do the right thing and have my medicine.
Now, you do have a grower.
No, sir, I do
you
not.
You don't have a grower.
I had one, but him and I kind of clashed. He had his own opinions, and I just want to do it the right way, the legal way.
So you do not have a grower or...
care provider? Nothing.
Care provider.
I'm without meds, and I don't know what I'm going to do next.
Okay.
And I have insomnia due to the excruciating pain, so...
Okay.
So I'm just one of those that's being messed around with by everybody, so... And I'm just trying to hook up and do the right thing for myself.
Okay.
Mr.
Thank you.
Could
yes.
I ask?
Yes.
How do you see solving the problem for you? What?
Measure 388. I've been through too much. And I'm going on my second year. I pay my money. I do my thing. Everything legally. And just too much misrepresentation and propaganda. And I just, you know, where do I go? What do I do? But Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation has been helping me understand it, educate me, and helping me network. So.
Okay. Well, it's important to have a network.
Yeah, because I don't know where I'd go.
Yeah. Okay. There are several networks, but it's important to have one. Okay. Thank you very much. Jerry?
Hello, my name is Jerry Wade, and I am an OMA patient and the secretary for the Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation. I know my time is limited, so I will give testimony on comments about and comment on Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments that have been added or are suggested to be added to our bill. Most of the people that have came so far have opposed Measure 33 have supported both the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments. But I do not believe they have adequately described what these provisions would really do to our law. Our current law doesn't allow anyone to sell marijuana. A grower can be reimbursed for the actual expenses incurred while helping a patient with their garden. All plants and marijuana produced are the property of the patient is being grown for, not the caregivers, and only the patients can give away excess medicine produced. The caregivers and growers legally cannot give away medicine because it does not belong to them. It belongs to the patient that they are growing it for. The Dash 1 amendments would fundamentally change OMA, giving the ownership of the garden to the growers. The first change would allow the grower to be reimbursed for marijuana by any cardholder, not just the cardholders that are registered at his garden or that he's growing for. The growers would decide who would receive medicine and how much. It would also expand OMA to allow the grower to charge for their time. And this would allow the grower to charge any amount they wanted for the medicine being produced. In California, the average growing price with the same type of operations, the exact same language they have, the average dispensary is selling medicine for $40 to $60 an eighth, anywhere from $320 to $400 an ounce. Most patients use about 3 ounces of medical marijuana a month, some 4 or 5, depending on their condition and how severe and how much they need. At those prices, a patient would have to come up with $1,500 a month that's not covered by any other insurance, that's not covered by anything other than out of their pocket, when marijuana only costs about $30 an ounce to grow. And then if you're growing outdoors, it's even much cheaper than that. So these prices of $300 an ounce are not asking for, you know, a reasonable time amount or, you know, for, you know, a wage. These are black market prices. What would happen is the Dash 1 amendment would fundamentally change. Okay. The growers would decide. So what this would be doing is you would be setting up small 24 plant dispensaries. They would decide who got the medicine, they could sell it to any cardholder, and they could sell it for whatever price they wanted. It would not be reimbursement, it would be the caregivers would be allowed to sell the medicine, and they would own it, not the patients who they're supposedly growing for. When you have a chance, please look at the cost analysis of I-28 that Stormy gave you on Monday. This was not prepared by the Stormy Ray Foundation. This was prepared by the people that support I-28. This came from their camp. And they estimated that marijuana would be sold for $40 an eighth. That's $320 per ounce. That's their numbers, not ours. The Dash 2 amendments would entirely remove the height limitations from the clones or seedlings allowed to allowing a garden to have 24 plants instead of 6 plants. You'd have 6 mature plants and 18 immature plants. This change would basically allow up to 96 plants at a garden site, 24 of them in bud at a time, and it would triple the amount that a 4-patient garden could produce. So at these numbers, a medical marijuana garden grown for 4 people could be producing 10 pounds a month. And those numbers are not patient numbers. They're not representative of what the patients within that garden would use. These numbers are set up to try to change our law to allow dispensaries in Oregon. And if you guys want to vote for that, I strongly support creating some type of supply system that's regulated, where the marijuana that is grown is not allowed to be sold, but for a reasonable price. Most patients use 3 or 4 ounces a month. People on low income making $600 a month can't afford 400 or 500 of it a month to be for their medicine. It's just not feasible when it's being grown for $30 a month.
Okay, you're going to have to wrap it up.
Okay, so that's basically my statement. So if you have any questions about what I've said, I'd be happy to answer them.
Do you have that in writing?
Yes, I do. I gave you a copy of that.
Okay, good. Okay, Jerry.
Okay, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, Barry Jo Stahl, Craig Barton, Anthony Johnson.
Good morning, Senator. Thanks for the opportunity. I'm testifying here today.
Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Oh, my name is Barry Jo Stahl. I'm testifying, as I do at these hearings, as a neutral. I just got my post office box bill, and since 1991, that's been sent to me as the Cannabis Research Institute. I started my Library of Congress research on cannabis in 1985, and I started using marijuana as medicine in 1980. I had a spinal cord injury and a car accident in 1976, so I've been using marijuana for quite some time. In 1989, I was charged with marijuana offenses, and the Portland police were doing a cleanup and gave a heroin addict drugs and money to inform on me. I started my college career up the street at the Oregon State Penitentiary, where I also found a legal gray area that was resolved by then the opinion was written by then Supreme Court Justice Kulongoski in Stahl versus Hoke, my own Supreme Court case that I prosecuted. I'm not an attorney. I'm just a smart guy that knows how to read. In 2004, I had a trial in Multnomah County Circuit Court where I was denied the defenses under the Medical Marijuana Act using a case called State versus OMB. That, as my appeal was progressing on that conviction, was overturned, the rationale had been made obsolete by the passage of the Medical Marijuana Act. The Court of Appeals affirmed my conviction. In 2005, my landlord, Portland nonprofit, brought a 30-day no-cause eviction. It was illegal for the landlord to file that eviction, as filing was a matter that was determined by Stahl versus Hoke, my own Supreme Court case, and twice as the appeal of that was going on, my landlord unlawfully destroyed my entire possessions, including
so what research. Are you here to testify?
So I'm here today to say that unless the courts and unless the police and the district attorneys are going to respect any law that we pass, you know, the politics takes place, of course, when you all are elected and when this process takes place. But if the but if it's not respected by the courts and the law enforcement authorities, then we're kind of spinning our wheels. And I'm just here to say, I'm living proof that, you know, the four times that my marijuana was seized, it was not returned under the mandate that's in the existing Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. So I see in some regards we're kind of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, as long as we're going to allow, I did see the hearing on the television the other day,
yeah.
And as long as we're going to allow law enforcement to present that known criminals are being known criminals, and that's the problem, then we're never going to get out of this. Now, I myself personally had to inform to the FBI on a medical marijuana patient who stole my medical marijuana. I brought a restraining order and got that under the Elderly Persons and Persons with Disabilities Abuse Prevention Act, and the trial court in Multnomah County dismissed that. That individual then went off to steal everything else that was there, having the green light by this very circuit court up in Multnomah County that I overturned, of course, with Stull versus Hoke, and set myself up for an ongoing series of really tragic events. So I'm a full-blown cannabis activist. The symbology on the gold man up there is he's got his cannabis-covered wagon, his temporary home, and he's here in Oregon with his axe, and he's making his permanent home. And this building is actually a monument to cannabis hemp, and it's not because it causes problems. It's because it's been outlawed, and prohibition causes problems. So if you'd like to contact me, I did give you my information. If you type that name into a search engine, you'll see articles like Police versus Hemp Fest that I was part of. And this has been an ongoing problem for me because when I incorporated a nonprofit in 1999 to implement the Medical Marijuana Act, I have since discovered that in many cases, the people that were operating from a motivation of social justice and kindness were simply put out of business by people who were motivated by greed and corruption, including, unfortunately, the folks who operating our court systems. So I'm here to answer any questions that you may have, and I would happily send you any information that you might solicit from me about any of these things. I've just been doing this for a really long time, and a lot of people hate me because I'm a know-it-all, and that's the function of me being trained to champion these very government institutions that are supposed to represent us and protect our interests, not cause the problems.
Thank you very much. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
Hi, I'm Gregory Barton, mm-hmm. and I'm an attorney from Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. I also have a master's degree in biochemistry and molecular biology and did medical research at OHSU for about 3.5 years while I was in graduate school there. That's where I received my master's degree. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to talk about is in terms of Senate Bill 388, I know there are proposed amendments to it, but I kind of wanted to start out by saying what we need to go back to here is what was the intent of this law when it was passed. And one of the primary intents of the law was to allow patients with debilitating medical conditions to use marijuana without fear of civil or criminal penalties. So without fear of civil or criminal penalties. And to make changes to existing Oregon laws that are necessary to protect patients and their doctors from criminal and civil penalties. And one of the things I think we need to ask ourselves in terms of the direction the law is heading right now is, are we promoting those purposes? Are we actually promoting the intent of the law, or are we creating essentially more traps for patients to fall into so that law enforcement can arrest patients and say, oh, look, people are abusing the act, this is a bad law, and we need to get rid of it. I mean, that's a concern I think a lot of patients have, is that what's happening is the law is being manipulated in ways to actually make criminals out of patients who are trying to get adequate supplies of medicine. One of the issues with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act is actually what is currently, the 12-inch rule, I'll call it, and in Senate Bill 388, the proposed bill contains an 18-inch rule where immature plants will be allowed to be 18 inches tall and up to 18 inches wide. The problem with these definitional rules in terms of maturity and immaturity of plants is that this is a continuously growing plant. And so you go to bed one night, you have 10-inch plants that are immature, you wake up the next morning, you have 12.5-inch plants as your immature plants. The police knock on your door, and you're under arrest for manufacturing a controlled substance. Okay, this is a problem. I mean, why should that be the case, that you can go to bed one night and wake up the next morning, and all of a sudden the police have you under arrest because your plants grew, 2.5 inches overnight? And it does happen. These plants grow very rapidly. And one of the other things, now the 18-inch law, you're going to have the same exact problem. The other issue is, okay, maturity has been defined in terms of flowering versus non-flowering plants as well, okay? And that's part of the definition of seedling or start versus a mature plant. A seedling or start has to be, less than 12 inches tall, 12 inches in diameter, and have no flowers. Okay, so now we have a power outage. The power goes out for 2 days, let's say. Your plants aren't getting any light. 3 days later, they're showing small flowers because of a power outage. The police come in again, and they say, oh, there are little flowers on these little small plants, and you're under arrest because they're no longer immature plants. And I think one of the things we can look to is Washington State recently looked at this issue and decided that what we need to do is have a law. There they decided what they need to do is have a law where the patient has a certain number of plants. It's black and white. Flowers, no flowers, size, whatever size. They picked 12 plants there. Okay, they picked 12 as the number. You can have 12 plants of any size. It's black and white. There's a clear line drawn. Because there's all this haziness in the law in terms of this 12-inch thing. The other thing about the 12 or 18-inch rule is if the plant in its naturally growing state, you measure it, it's less than 12 inches wide. But then, the police say, we really want to do something. We're in this garden. We feel like we want to make an arrest here. And so what happens there if they take the branches and they say, if we bend these branches down a little bit, it's more than 12 inches now. I mean, how do we, this definition doesn't work. 12, 18 inches? It's an issue.
Yeah.
Okay. And it does happen. That kind of thing does happen. And that's the problem with this type of a definitional approach.
Okay. Now, you're an attorney, and you deal with people who grow medical marijuana, is that
right? I do.
And do you find that the police are picking on people that without probable cause?
I believe that the police do throw their weight around on this issue to a significant extent, and I believe they generally oppose this law, That's my belief, is I think they generally oppose this law and feel like it's being abused, which is what the presentation on Monday, they talked about.
Yeah.
The abuse, while showing almost all pictures of compliant gardens, interestingly enough.
Okay.
But that's, but to me, this is this is a primary issue in terms of we want to protect patients from criminal liability, 12 inches, 18 inches, it isn't working. Give us just a number.
Well, I guess my intent, and I think the intent of the committee, is to protect this law. We want, this law has been constitutionally, it's been passed by the people, I should say, several times. And not constitutionally, but statutorily. And if there is significant abuse of this law, then there will be significant opposition to even having it. And my feeling is that we want to make sure that people who need medical marijuana are able to get it. And there is a fine line there that we have to find that protects the right of the people, the growers, the caregivers, the patients, and also the public in terms of abuse of the law. Now, there, I have an email, which I won't read entirely, but this is a bust in Lincoln City, March 3rd, 70 plants were seized. The Lint team had been investigating for a while, went in. They had a card, but there was this was an ongoing investigation, and that's the sense that I get, is that these things don't just happen immediately. There's someone makes a complaint, and they start watching, and they find abuses in the system.
Well, if they have a card and there's 70 plants, I mean, that's clearly way over the limit. I mean, I'm talking about people who are trying to comply who are having problems.
I hope the courts don't get flooded with people who are really not out of... Well, if they're out of compliance, it's not a major issue. It's not a major violation of being out of compliance. I'm hoping that that is not the case.
It is, though. It's treated as a Class A felony. I mean, if you have one plant over 12 inches tall in your immature plants, and the police measure it, that one plant is now a Class A felony. Not expungible, not ever...
Okay. I guess my understanding of investigations are as a result of complaints or probable cause to take a look at a particular grower. Anyway, so thank you very much. And your name, please?
My name is Anthony Johnson.
Anthony.
Yes. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, thank you for hearing our testimony today. I come to oppose Senate Bill 388 as written, and I do support the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, and I agree wholeheartedly with Mr. Barton that the noncompliance issues are a big problem because, like he stated, patients and growers are allowed to have 6 mature plants and 18 seedlings, and you've complied with the law. Mm-hmm. But if your plant, one of your seedlings becomes over 12 inches tall, and you now have 7 mature plants and 17 seedlings, you're now a felon. Mm-hmm. And that's carried out differently from county to county. In Multnomah County, the law enforcement is likely to tell you one plant is too tall and cut it down or, you know, get rid of it, and you'll be in compliance. Whereas in other counties, say Douglas County, more rural counties, some patients and growers are looking at felony charges and overthrow their homes for being a couple plants over. And 388, in my opinion, just adds, you know, more room for patients and growers who are trying to be compliant to be out of compliance. And there are always going to be abuse or noncompliance of the system because there are abuse and noncompliance of every system. You know, Social Security fraud, Medicare fraud, prescription drug fraud, fraud in food assistance, there's always going to be these abuses. And no matter what law you put into place, and we saw the PowerPoint presentation by law enforcement, and there are noncompliance issues, and it seems to me those noncompliance issues are being dealt with by law enforcement, and that's they're doing a good job with a lot of these cases. But those issues of noncompliance are going to be there whether patients are allowed to have 24 ounces of hash or only 2 ounces of hash. And so law enforcement will be back in 2 years, next legislative session, saying there's more noncompliance, and that's always going to be there. I urge this committee and other members of the legislature to look at a regulated supply system. There is now a Senate Bill 812, which is based off Initiative 28, that's been polled in favor by 59% of Oregon voters. There are these issues of abuse, and there does seem to be a concerted effort by opponents of the medical marijuana program and law enforcement to point out these abuses. But even after 10 years of these so-called significant abuses, the medical marijuana program is still favored by 63% of Oregon voters. I think it's hard to state that there are many politicians or government programs that are that popular statewide. And so it seems to me the program is working for the most part of keeping most patients and growers out of prison. What we do need is a regulated supply system. Senate Bill 812 would establish a regulated supply system. It would establish a program to assist low-income patients who are in need get access to medical marijuana. It would establish a research program so we can get some quality controls and studies into medical marijuana, and it would generate millions of dollars of revenue. And I think there are some issues of compliance that advocates and law enforcement could agree on. If we need more extensive background checks of growers or caregivers and make sure felons from other states don't come here, I think that's things we can all agree on. But limiting the amount of medicine that patients can have is not going to solve anything. It's just going to push more patients into the black market. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Well, let's see. I'll go back to the list. Darren Watkins and Jim Klar.
Hi, I'm Darren Watkins. I'm a medical marijuana patient. I'm with the Mercy Center, and I would just really like to back up what the last two gentlemen and said that I oppose it, and just really everything they said, it was, they just really took the words right out of my mouth. So.
Oh, okay, good. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Jim Klar. I am a chief executive officer for Oregon Green Free on the board of directors. Our organization has over 3,000 continuous members. We've served probably close to 10. Our by need for the public incorporation has just passed its 6 years. We were formed because of the need of people on the Oregon Medical Program, and we are an educational background or nonprofit. With that said, we have dealt with all of the differences in patient-grower concerns. We have offered mediation since the beginning, which is one of the focuses we wanted to do. Our mission is to make people self-reliant so that they don't have to contend with anything except for their own grow under the rules of the law. I'm also a member of the Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana, appointed by Dr. Goldberg. And my main issue that I'd like to actually focus on at this point is the issue of having the Department of Human Services do compliance checks, mediation, and those type of issues. After doing these for 6 years ourselves, I can tell you they're extremely difficult. We base ours on the fact that patients and growers meet personally and they sign an agreement between them. If they don't have an agreement between them for a foundation, we certainly can't do any form of mediation because there's no thing left except for he said, she said. Out of those mediations that we have done to keep people happy with each other, try to solve their problems, all the ones that we have dealt with that have met our specifications have been done successfully with not just one of the parties being satisfied with when it was over, but both. But out of hundreds and hundreds of these, there's only been probably less than 25 where people actually met those standards and had those agreements. So it became very difficult for us to do these. We still do them. And I could only imagine, because I know that we get a lot of the same type of calls, a lot of the same type of inquiries from people that the OMMP does. As a matter of fact, at times people call us thinking we are the OMMP. because we work very tightly with their rules and regulations, and that's the one main thing I wanted to say about that. I really don't think that's a burden that the Department of Human Services wishes to take on, nor do I believe they really should. As far as I-28 goes, which I'm also a chief petitioner for, and the economic prospectus, I can tell you that that was not done from $300 an ounce. It was done from $150 an ounce after paying the producers $150 an ounce for them. That would go towards what I know after 6 years of working for free to the costs and overheads of running even a business. I consider it to not look at it as a dispensary, but non-profit resource centers who choose to dispense, because not all would have to. We also engage with every other social service we can. We have the phone numbers and names of all other social programs that are up there, people that are having problems, whether it's SSI, SSD, rape crisis lines, mental health. They can get those as a way to use our resource center.
What's the name of your group again?
It's Oregon Green Free.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Loma Anderson?
Lonnie
Anderson.
That would be Lonnie.
Lonnie.
Howdy. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I've been an OMP member for 4 years.
Give us your name again.
Oh, my name is Lonnie Sean Anderson. I live here on Lone Oak, just up the road a little ways. Excuse me. It's kind of. I've been an OMP car holder for 4 years. I don't know about every other place, but I kind of know Salem. And I was here last time for the meetings and this time, and I've seen a lot of kind of different things. I support Stormy, and I've contacted all these different organizations. When I started 4 years ago, I started because I ripped both arms out of socket. But 2 years ago, God gave me a little brainstem tumor for a present for Christmas. So that kind of is what keeps me on it somewhat. And that's kind of why I'm nervous now. And in this last 4 years, I have seen a lot of abuses in this program, not in Stormy's program, but the way this was set up. When I first started, I tried to get little girls. I got a little girl that had two leaves on it that cost me $35 that it took me 3 months to nurse back to health. I contacted some organizations to try to get some kind of things like that. Well, they have times for different things. Now, if you come up on a Friday night, that's a party night because we don't do business until Saturday. I've never been to a doctor where we all sit down and ate Oxycontins before he's seen me. And it was like a zoo when I talked to some of these different organizations. I don't go to the doctors to party. I go to the doctors to get relief for pain. Stormy was probably the only organization, or the only organization, that was straight up, straightforward, that helped me for anything that I needed. I can honestly say that there are some things that I agree with Stormy, and there's some other things that I see that Stormy would say that I'm a visionary. I have a lot of friends. I was a shop steward for 12 years through the union. I had a lot of friends who got crippled up and things like that, and they went to prescription pills. Some of them are stuck on a Social Security income and stuff like that of $658 a month, which is probably now about $700. If you start talking to dispensaries, and they have to pay some kind of like $50 an ounce, they can't pay that. If they smoke 3 ounces a week, that leaves them a little over $458 a month to live on. What kind of house can you find? What kind of apartment? My house payment's $2,400 a month. Thank God Oregon Health and Science Center gives me $2,000 a month worth of free medicine. 2 years ago when I grew my outside crop, I ended up with 6 pounds. I didn't know what to do with it. Holding on to it was against the law. So I took it up to Portland and gave it to two different places, 3 pounds at a time, so I wouldn't break the law transporting it, because I was scared of the cops. They looked at me like I was an idiot handing them 3 pounds. If I would have known what I know now, I would have tried to do things. If they have a dispensary, I think it should be on a sliding scale. You can't put somebody on that. Me and my fiance make almost $5,000 a month. But I have no money left for any prescriptions on that. My prescription's $2,000 a month for the Depakote. And that's them giving it to me. If I had to buy it, it'd be $2,400. If they did a dispensary, which Stormy Ray hasn't really got that yet because she has so many other things that she's doing. But the dispensary and things like that, those people should get that for free. There's no cost. And on things like that, where I grew it for me, I ended up with all this extra stuff. I didn't know what to do with it. Throw it away and give it to the goats. My goats like it, but they act awful strange. The abuses.
Okay, you're going to have to wrap up.
So many people that they would get an ounce. The biggest thing in Salem is maybe an ounce or two a month. They just can't do that. So many people on them, well, that's what you get, an ounce or two a month. That's not what it is, and that's not what they grow. On the outside, I average a pound and a half a plant on the outside. And that probably cost me, I probably put $400 into it, and I ended up with almost 15 pounds. I didn't know what to do with it. Okay. I could have gave it to a dispensary. I will not take up any more of your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Alicia. Alicia Williamson. And David Booth. Introduce yourself, please.
Yes, my name's Alicia Williamson. I drove here from Washington County.
Okay.
I apologize, I wasn't preparing to give testimony today, but I was here on Monday,
and
I would like to comment. I was very taken aback by the law enforcement PowerPoint. One thing that disturbed me was there was no citation or any indication where they were getting some of their data, which I find very odd. And I just wanted to share an experience from the other side, because law enforcement feels so put upon by this law. I'm an advocate. I also am a grower caregiver for my husband and one other patient. We live in the country in a small farm. We were robbed 2 years ago where the fencing was cut. You know, it was, I called the Washington County Sheriff's Office. The officer who came out was delightful. He spent 2 hours there getting evidence. He commented that whoever cut that fence was a very powerful, large person with bolt cutters. He was on the case. And since we're in a very small rural area, I asked around. You know, I said, did anyone notice anyone near our property? And bingo, someone came up and said, you know, these guys are right up the hill and they're selling this marijuana hand over fist. It's not cured. It's wet. People are a little curious where it came from. We think they're the ones who did it. I drove up there. I look up. They've thrown the stalks right there by the side of their driveway. I call back and my nice officer from Washington County, and I said, I have been told, and I've sort of verified, would you like to come out and take a look? Here's the names of these people. And he said, oh, yeah, they're very well-known ne'er-do-wells. Not surprised. I will call you right back. He was kind of excited. And he was a good man, and he did call me back right back, and he said, I have been told to stand down. I am required to hand this over to the Washington County Interagency Narcotics Team. And I say, well, why? It's a robbery. It's a robbery report that you have. I've been told because it's marijuana, I have to do this. I'm so sorry. And I said, okay, that's fine. He said, here's our case number. Here's the number to call. I called for 3 weeks. I finally got one of these WIN officers. He was, why are you bothering us? I said, well, at this point, there's probably not much of my patient's medicine to get back. He said, well, we're not going to do anything about that. And I said, well, I thought selling cannabis was a crime, also robbery. And he said, look, lady, if it was your lawnmower, we'd be up there right now. But it's marijuana. And that's the policy here. And I'm not sure if you're aware, there's been controversy in the newspaper because Sheriff Rob Gordon has stated that he regards the OMA, which is the law, to be advice. So that's just, as a person who called upon law enforcement in an instance where we're totally legal. That officer came to my garden. He looked at everything there. And he was a patrol
guy. Now, wait a minute. Okay, the officer was in the sheriff's department?
Oh, Washington County Sheriff's,
okay.
Regular patrolman, who came out to my call.
And the Lint team, who were the other people who didn't?
Washington County has their interagency.
Yeah, interagency. Yeah.
So, again, it was a Washington County sheriff's personnel or part of that unit.
Yeah.
And they said, well, we won't do anything about it. That's our policy.
Now, when was this?
This was 2 years ago.
Okay. And have things changed?
I haven't been robbed again, so I haven't, you know. And I have to say...
So your interaction with the... You haven't had interaction then with the sheriff's department again?
I haven't been robbed. Okay. I mean, I have no reason to...
Okay. Well, that's interesting information.
But I just wanted to share, you know, there's another side to this story when you...
Yeah.
Because the law is now, you can pick up that telephone and call the police and say, please help me. And when they tell you, well, we're not going to because we don't approve of the law, it's very disturbing. And so the other point, you know, I'll wrap up here, is that this bill seems to want law enforcement to have even more access to come around, I believe, reading, oh, well, we want to know who, be able to reach the patient and interview them. And it's like if you're not even protecting patients and caregivers who are calling you, with the name of the robbers. I mean, why do they want this information?
Okay, good. Thank you very much for that information. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Chairman, Senators of the Committee. My name is David Booth. I live in Rickrail, Oregon. I'm speaking against Senate Bill 388 today, and I'm desperately trying to remain just another calm voice of reason. I was the one who provided this report to you guys. I think you may have gotten it already, and I hope it's helpful to see some of the view from the other side. I also wrote just an addendum based on... I wrote an original testimony. I just left it alone and presented it for you, and I wrote just an addendum based on what has been said since recently. I'm trying to ask a simple question of what is the real abuse that's been present in the law. And when I saw the police officers or the law enforcement's presentation, it seemed to me that everything was really easy to understand, that they found people who were selling, they found people who didn't have documentation for a grow site, they found grow sites. I don't know how you get 96 big plants in any way, shape, or form. I understood 4 grow cards per address was kind of a limit, but I don't actually know myself. And it seems to me all those things were very easy. They even expressed doubt, like one garden could be out of compliance on one day, and then when they contact the OMMP, they find out that it's compliant after the fact. But that just shows a backlog. It shows the success of the program and the fact that they're 2 or 3 months behind. And the way that problem is solved is really easy. Whenever I turn in my paperwork, I get a stamped receipt that I turned it in, and it's got a date and everything from the office, and I take it right to the grow site and staple it to the door. And there's 3 of them there at my place, and it's right there with the expiration dates and everything. So I don't really understand why, you know, except for the police raising the point about they might not know how many, which they can find out by phone, I didn't see that they were really hampered in the current situation. Because I understood you can't sell it at all. I also wanted to raise the issue of perspective. They throw around a lot of numbers of how many and how big and this and that, and people talk about how confusing the law is. I haven't found it to be so confusing. But the one thing that I think is really kind of an elephant in the room is that 24 ounces has been tossed around, and I'd like to say it should always be at least a year's supply. They showed you mostly outdoor gardens. That's a once-a-year cycle. So anything less than a year's supply would be kind of not really fair to talk about. But how much is 24 ounces? If it was tobacco, it would be 900 cigarettes. And can you imagine telling your smoking friends that they're allowed 2 cigarettes a day on weekdays, 3 cigarettes on weekend days, and they get 3 bonus cigarettes every month except February? I mean, that's what 24 ounces is. And I saw a guy rolling out of Costco the other day, and he had, I don't know, 50 cartons of cigarettes? I don't know. Yeah, but 900 cigarettes is about $180. You know. But then on the other side, 24 ounces, because of prohibition, has become $7,500. And so people like Stormy Ray here, I really understand her basic position that it's supposed to be the patient's medicine. And I understand that, but the same people speaking on behalf there are saying that they acknowledge a point where cost for expenses happens. So the medicine doesn't automatically happen, and then it's automatically the patient's if there's a reimbursement step. And there's volunteers like me who make it happen. And they don't make the value be so much by the black market. That's done by our society, and that's a history we all kind of know about, and we can't fix that here today. But I couldn't see what 388 really does to help patients get medicine. I saw the law enforcement people talk about protecting the patients and victimizing, but I know there must be unscrupulous growers. I mean, draconian laws can have an effect. And I know Texas has very, very harsh laws against marijuana. I've driven through there one time. And so I'm not surprised that a few people dribble over from Texas, you know. And if that's really what the police are saying is the big problem, it seems to me they already got those people ready to take them to jail. So I just couldn't see how 388 helped people get medicine. Okay. So anyway, and I'd like to answer any questions you might have. Okay.
You did submit several pages of testimony.
Yeah, I'm about to say something.
Questions?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Neil?
Neil Feldman.
Okay. Yeah, Neil Feldman.
Brian.
And Brian Nichols. Oh, Michael. Brian Michaels is on the phone. Brian, are you there?
No, Brian Michaels is here, I think. He just gave him a note.
Okay. Brian, are you Brian?
Brian Michael?
Yeah.
Oh. I was waiting to hear the last name, but there are other people named. But I didn't hear my last name, so I wasn't sure if it's
anything. And you came all the way from Eugene, right?
I did.
Yeah, good. That's a long way.
Is it my turn?
Go ahead.
Your turn. My turn?
Go ahead. No, your turn.
My turn.
You were here first.
Okay. My name is Neil Feldman. I'm a resident of Salem. Thank you very much for hearing my testimony. On 388, I'm kind of for it, against it, and neutral. There's different parts of it that I, have issues with. What I was really hoping to see with this were a few things. Somebody on Monday mentioned the concept, like with myself, I have a chronic pain issue. I'm not getting better. The best I can hope for is to not get worse. Having to go in every year, you know, to do the whole thing is quite a bit of a hassle and an expense on a limited income. It would be kind of nice if we had, like, you know, if your doctor said it was a chronic thing, it was an ongoing thing, maybe every 5 or 10 years you could sit there and do it. You know, so it's not forever, but, you know, you keep an eye on it. But, you know, the other thing, I was at the advisory committee meeting that was in Salem, and one of the things that came up was that the law requires a definition of immature plant. And right now there is no definition of immature plants in the law. There is seedling and start, which is the 12-inch or 18-inch as 388 is going, and there's mature plant, which is a flowering plant. And by botany, you know, by any botanist you ask, an immature cannabis plant would be anything larger than a seedling or start that is not flowering. And that would solve, if that definition was in there, it would solve the problem of the going to bed and your plant grew 2 inches. As long as there's no flowers on it, it shouldn't matter how big the plant is. As far as it being an immature plant, it should count as part of your 18, not part of your 6. As far as the hashish definition and so on in there, I agree with other people that say that there's really no point to that, because the law already states any and all preparations and concoctions from the plant. And I really just have to wonder, I mean, I saw the whole Beasley thing in Kaiser back in 07, and I kept asking, what part of any and all are they unclear on? I mean, they're pretty all-inclusive terms. you know, it doesn't matter what it is. And I don't see a reason necessarily. I mean, I can see if you really want to limit it to 2 ounces of hash, fine, whatever. I don't see anybody piling up 24 ounces of hash. It would take one heck of a lot of cannabis to make 24 ounces of hash. So there's no real point in that. Another thing that Oregon does not have, which two of the states that do have a medical marijuana plan have, which I would really love to see, is reciprocity. Is it Montana and Rhode Island? That if you have, if I go to Rhode Island, I have my Oregon card, I'm legal there. If somebody from Rhode Island comes here, they're not. And that's kind of unfair, and it really should basically cover the things. And the other thing is basically, as somebody was mentioning earlier, the police generally, as a rule, are, well, let's put a point on it, they're not particularly supportive of the Oregon medical marijuana plan. And as happened again in Kaiser, there was a pretty extreme harassment case. The guy ended up getting evicted out of his house because of it. He got arrested, spent 5 days in jail for it, and all the rest of it. They blew up his medication, literally, didn't replace it. I would love to see something in there that anybody, either citizen or official, but especially officials like police who are sworn to uphold the law, whether they like it or not, that it be a Class C felony for them to interfere with, harass, or intimidate patients or caregivers or growers who are complying with the law. It would just...
You have to wrap up.
Okay, and I do apologize for that. And there was one other thing along those lines. Oh, yeah, the 4 month supply thing. I think you're running into a... I agree that there should not be, like, if you take a 10-pound lasagna and put an aspirin in it, it doesn't make a 10-pound aspirin. You know, it should count the amount of medication that's in the food and count that against the 24 ounces, because otherwise, what's 4 months' supply? I can eat a whole lot of Rice Krispie treats or whatever in 4 months, or chicken soup or whatever. It depends on the person what it is. Mm-hmm. And you're just opening a can of worms for yourself on that. If you want it to be, concise and easily understandable, you don't want vague.
Okay. Good.
But thank you very much for hearing me.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Brian?
Hi. My name is Brian Michaels. I'm an attorney in Eugene, Oregon. And I travel around the state, and one of the areas of my practice is medical marijuana. I defend people who have been charged with crimes stemming from the medical marijuana program, as well as filing lawsuits against police who have abused people who are on the medical marijuana program. So I kind of see it from a variety of perspectives, as well as from a variety of geographies. It is not prosecuted uniformly across the state. And a lot of what allows for some, shall we say, overactive prosecutions is this sort of numbers game, which I'd like to get into a little bit. I see, for example, they go in and they try to count the number of plants that are 12 inches high. And I don't know where the 12 inches came from, but it doesn't flow from a botanical or a scientific origin. It flows more from a random origin. And then it is used to satisfy a political agenda on law enforcement. And I think if we can agree on anything about legislature is best when it's driven by science or symptoms than when it's driven by politics or prejudice. And there is no science that gives us 12 inches. Plants grow. You can't legislate plants. You can only legislate human behavior. So plants are growing. They grow more than 12 inches. They're not doing any buds. They're just growing. And the person is trying to figure out which one is going to be good for their 6 major plants. The police come in, and suddenly they got A felonies, and they're charged with A felonies. I've seen police have photographs stretching plants to make it 12 inches. So this numbers game, it really is a cliff rather than an advisory situation. So where does that play in? Well, I don't know why people are all up in arms about hash. Mr. Feldman mentioned Mr. Beasley. He's one of my clients. I don't know why they arrested this man. He had a medical marijuana card. He had hashish. They put him in jail. They prosecuted him. They ruined his life for a while. Hashish is legal. So the symptom, I think, or the science, I think, isn't that we need to make hash illegal. The symptom is that hash isn't a real problem. It's no one's really having a problem with too much hash. Why are we regulating and imposing the numbers game into hash now? It invites more political agendas than it solves any real problems. And I'll also tell you that in my practice, I have come across a lot of people who came to marijuana first as a medicine. Many middle class, never would think of a drug in their life kind of people. One person was the brother of a client of mine who got hurt on the job for the first time, busted his shoulder up really bad. For 6 months he was on pain meds. He described to the jury that he couldn't hug his kids. When he went to work, he was zoned out. And his brother, who, you know, did not come to marijuana first as a medicine, encouraged him to use it as a medicine. And he did. And he said, you know, within a week, I was able to hug my children. I was able to hug my wife. I was able to work at my job because I was awake. I wasn't numbed out. And this is somebody who, if you met him, you would believe him when he tells you, up until that point, he thought pot was just something stupid hippies did, and it wasn't for a good, working, hardworking American like him. So there is a certain medicinal value here that cannot be understated, cannot be overstated. That people who cried, one woman in a similar situation, her mother was dying of cancer on her cancer bed. She said, you know, they're giving me this for the pain and to help me eat. It might help you. She had years of problems like that. In a week or two, like that. Its value cannot be overstated as a medicine. But we also have decades and decades and decades of inertia of law enforcement and judges putting people in prison for this product. And it's very hard for those people, I've learned across the state, to say, gee, yesterday I was putting you in jail and taking your children, and now it's okay. And they haven't really all gotten over all of that. They still see it as an evil weed. And so when you write these laws, you have to insert into the law that there is going to be a certain inertia, a certain political agenda in the enforcement of these laws on people who are really only trying to help themselves and others. And there's a lot of community around medical marijuana patients to help each other. It's enormous. There's a certain social status pride of giving marijuana to people without getting any money.
Okay, you're going to have to wrap it up.
I would say reciprocity is something that, you know, it's an unsettled area of law, but we do have a full faith and credit in the Constitution. There's no reduction in our state's laws to allow for medical marijuana to have reciprocity as well as we do for OxyContin and any other drugs. It would be easier if it was stated in a law because we have the full faith and credit. Right now it's an unsettled area of law. The idea of Section 2D is something I will close on. I don't know why somebody who's allowed to grow for four patients somehow has to manage his or her gardens so that they only have 24 ounces of marijuana collectively. That's a numbers game that's going to cause a lot of people to get arrested. There's no doubt about it. All you're doing is creating crime where crime doesn't really ordinarily have to exist. And frankly, I with the budget and all of this, I don't know why this is an area you want to invite law enforcement resources to be spent on patients who are trying to be healthy. I guess my time is up.
Yeah, good. Thank you,
questions,
Brian.
Questions or anything?
Questions. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. We're going to have to do that later.
Okay.
We're going to close the public hearing on this issue. Okay, where are we going? Okay, 388 is over. We closed the public hearing on 388. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 163.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 163 has been heard twice by the committee, both on February 4th and February 18th. We were waiting last time for the fiscal analysis on the Dash 2 amendments. We have now received that information, and there is no fiscal impact noted on those particular amendments. No,
That was, that Stormy's amendment?
No.
You had a dash one?
No.
I don't know.
I got the dash two and three from Don, so.
Okay, we do two and three from Don. Do we have any testimony on?
We're
just doing a work
session. I think
work
we're just,
session.
We just moved the dash two and moved the bill at this point.
Let's go on the dash two,
okay,
Mr. Chair.
Okay,
we have that now.
Okay.
We are in work session,
okay,
right?
Yeah. We are now in work session on Senate Bill 163.
Chair, I move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 163.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the dash two amendments on Senate Bill 163. Discussion, opposition, seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 163 as amended by the dash two amendment to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 163 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. discussion, opposition, so ordered. We will open a...
Who's going to carry that?
Oh, anybody want to volunteer to carry that bill?
Okay.
Okay. Senator Marcy Sanderson will carry Senate Bill 163. Okay, public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 37. Would you tell us about Senate Bill 137, please?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 37 was originally heard on the committee on January 21st. If you recall, it creates a new provision under ORS 414725, which requires DHS to adopt rules and procedures to ensure that a rural health clinic receives payment from a prepaid managed care plan for services, and to ensure that the payment to the clinic of the difference between what the clinic received from the plan and other insurers and the amount due from the department is not less than the amount that would be received in DHS's fee-for-service payment system. It requires DHS to reimburse the RHC within 45 days of receiving a claim. Excuse me.
Okay. Elizabeth?
Chair, do you have the fiscal impact statement? Is it? Do I have it?
Yeah, you should have it.
Oh. It just came this morning, so we didn't have... We
all
just
right.
Put it on the dais.
All right. In here. Here it is. Why don't I have it?
Pat West will submit electronically. Okay.
Oh, yeah. I have it.
Okay. Seeing no others wishing to testify, close the public hearing. And open a work session.
Yeah.
Go ahead with a motion.
Well, just a comment first, if I
yeah.
could.
Well.
I might question some of these figures. I'm not sure I buy the FTE, but that would be a discussion they could have in Ways and Means.
Yeah.
So, with that, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 37 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moved Senate Bill 37 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Wait a minute now. Are we going to go to Ways and Means?
Yeah, with the
first.
You got to. No. You move it to the floor with a due pass with a subsequent referral.
Okay. To the floor with a due pass with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. A question. When we first discussed this, it was the issue was more a timing of the $50,000. Now all of a sudden we've got FTE and fiscal impact that's far in excess of $50,000, which was just merely a cash flow timing issue. So I guess I'm perplexed by the fiscal impact of this bill.
DHS was here. Scott, could you see if there's someone in the hall, if DHS is in the hall?
Right in the back.
Oh, Jim Edge. I'm sorry, Jim.
He was hiding, but not very well.
You were hiding back there, Jim.
Right.
Jim, would you address the committee, please?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Jim Edge from the Department of Human Services. I understand you have a question about the fiscal impact on Senate Bill 37.
Yeah.
This bill speeds up the payments to rural health clinics by the department.
Yes.
There is a one-time cost associated with doing that. It moves some costs that would normally be paid in the next biennium into this biennium, amounting to, looking quickly at the fiscal, a little over $200,000 general funds, a little over $500,000 total funds in that one-time speed up of payment. There's also one additional FTE associated with that because it actually creates a situation where we would do two supplemental payments in these situations where another entity pays a rural health clinic and then the department comes in and does a subsequent payment to pay them the full amount that DHS pays in these situations. We would, under this bill, do an estimated additional payment and then do a full truing up in a secondary additional payment. So there's a small cost associated with an additional FTE of $77,000 general funds associated with that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If we took the emergency clause off, what would the impact be? Then there would be no impact on this biennium at all.
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, if there were no additional payments this biennium, there would be no fiscal impact this biennium.
Mr. Chair, that might be something we might want to consider. I mean, we're having enough trouble with this biennium as it is. I like what we're doing here, but if we take the emergency clause off, we aren't impacting two bienniums with this bill.
Okay. Other comments?
I'd like comments from you regarding an emergency clause. Would that make it worse at some point in time, or?
Chair Morissette, Senator Moniz Anderson, it would move out the speed up of payments to next biennium and create the same scenario in
That's
the next
right.
biennium.
And we've heard that next biennium is even worse than this biennium.
Chair Morissette, Senator Moniz Anderson, I can't answer that question. You probably have a better answer than I do for that.
Okay. I guess my feeling is that this is a very important bill that would keep some clinics from closing. Clinics are at risk. Anyway, and I would like this to go to the Ways and Means Committee for discussion with the hope that there would be some movement of stimulus money and other monies that would fund this particular bill and this project, and it might rise to the top. And this is not, you know, there are two reasons we send bills to Ways and Means. One, to kill the bill, the other one, to hope that the bill gets support in that body after listening to testimony at that particular time. And having met with some people from clinics yesterday and hearing some of their concerns, I feel even more strongly that we need to move this bill along.
Mr. Chair, I'm perfectly fine sticking with my motion. I just threw something on the table, but
yeah.
If you want to move it the way it is, I'm perfectly fine doing that.
Yes, Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still perplexed with the cost of doing this. The cash flow issue, I understand totally, but the cost of changing a time frame in which something is reimbursed that needs $70,000 of personnel and supply costs to do that just perplexes me. I'm sorry, it might be my CPA background, but I just can't understand when you're writing checks a little bit quicker and dispersing monies a little bit quicker, why that requires $70,000 of additional personnel and supply costs.
Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, it's quite a bit more complex than writing checks. There is a complicated process of calculations to determine what has been paid by a number of different third-party payers, which may be managed care organizations, it may be Medicare, it may be other third-party payers, and then truing it up against what DHS pays that clinic. We have one full-time person doing these payments for rural health clinics right now. We would basically double the number of supplemental payments we would be making with this new methodology. And I'm not saying I oppose this methodology. It would allow us to get cash flow to these clinics faster, but we would do it by estimating a secondary payment and then doing a further set of calculations that would true it up to a complete true calculation at a later point. So it would basically double the workload of the calculations of the payments.
Go ahead.
Follow up then. So the additional, these checks are going to get written anyway. By moving it to 45 days, we're dealing with an estimate then. And is that what's requiring the extra work? I mean, this work is going to be done anyway and is currently being done. We just want to make it faster. And so there's a requirement for an estimate. So is it the estimate that's creating the need for this one FTE? Because the workload, the task is still the same. It's just it being done in 45 days.
Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, there will be two sets of calculations that need to be done under the new scenario. It will be an estimate, a set of estimates, and then a set of final calculations.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm concerned that errors are going to be made, and we may be running into an overpayment or an underpayment, because if you estimate what a third-party carrier is going to be able to pay or not be able to pay, you're estimating that, and therefore, if then all of a sudden Medicare says, sorry, that's not being covered, then you were underestimating. So the way the system is now gives you more leeway in seeing what the third-party payers are going to be able to pay. And so that's the issue. Am I understanding that?
Chair Morissette, Senator Moniz Anderson, yes, you're right. The process of estimating what the truing up of the calculations will be could result in either slightly overpaying or slightly underpaying if the estimates aren't exactly on. It could result in the final calculation being either a need to pay just a little more or to collect back some overpayment that's been made to the rural health clinic.
And what is the average amount of time that you are able to reimburse rural health clinics, or is it across the board depending on what you're being billed for?
Senator Morissette and Senator Moniz Anderson, a 45-day payment time is what we strive for after we've received all of the information that needs to be received. But you're right, it's across the board when we receive the third-party information, the information especially about what Medicare has paid, can be 6 to 9 months or longer before we get all that information and then do our payments. So that's the dilemma for the rural health clinics, is that in some cases it can take as long as 9 months to get the information. Then we add our 45 days to it to do the final calculation, and it can be something close to 11 or 12 months before they get their final payments.
Yeah. So how do we handle this if Medicare then decides not to pay, or you find that you overpay? Isn't that going to actually result in more work for bureaucracy and trying to then deal with that with the rural health clinics?
Chair Morissette, Senator Moniz-Anderson, yes, that would. In a case where Medicare ultimately did not pay or paid more than had been estimated, we would have the issue of collecting the overpayment from the rural health clinic.
That's the frustration of this, because the rural health clinics need a cash flow, and yet so does the state, because we need to get that reimbursement from the feds. So anyway, Mr. Chair, that's why I'm a no on this, not because I don't want our rural health clinics to be reimbursed, but it's putting a bigger burden on the Department of Human Services, because we need to be getting those payments from the feds. So if we get our delegation to make them pass this same law at the federal level, then I wouldn't have a problem, because I think then we'd be getting reimbursement quicker from the feds.
Okay, if you make the reimbursement on bills submitted within 45 days and have a period of reconciliation, do you have a period of reconciliation on 6 months or an entire year where you would reconcile?
Senator Morissette, we can do the reconciliation fairly quickly after we receive the final information about what the other payer has paid. That's the unknown in this issue, is often in the, especially in the case of Medicare, that can be a lengthy amount of time that before we receive the information about what that third payer has paid.
Okay, up to a year, 9 months.
Chair Morissette, I've heard that it has taken up to a year to make some payments because of the length of time that the other payer has taken to make their payment.
But the thing in the balance here is the quicker reimbursement. And okay, is Medicare the only one that you have to wait that long for? I mean, the other third payer.
Chair Morissette, no. There can be payments by Medicaid managed care plans. There can be payments by insurance companies. There can be payments by a variety of other payers. The ones that are mentioned in the bill are the Medicaid managed care plans, but I think the ones that I've heard the representatives of rural health clinics complain most about is the Medicare payments that are so slow.
Other comments? Okay.
Mr. Chair, yes. I really think it's going to be very difficult sending something with this kind of addition of to Ways and Means. You know, with the money, sure. I think the best of all worlds is that they do it in 45 days. Even if it's an estimate, but it would have to be within 45 days. But I don't agree with the added cost. I mean, when we were presented this bill, I have to agree with Senator Telf. It was just a timing thing, and it was not going to be very expensive. It was just encouraging them to get it done within a shorter period of time because of the cash flow. And I don't find the explanation of the added cost satisfactory either.
Ms. Chair, I would agree. But I think the place to have that debate is in Ways and Means, as to let them drill into the to what LFO has put on the table. I mean, we could hold on to it and go have a talk with John about it, but that discussion is going to happen somewhere. Our job is to deal with the policy. Do we think this is a good policy? And I think it is good policy. And I think the folks in the Ways and Means Sub might have issue with some of these figures, and that would be the place to have the discussion.
Other comments?
Just one other. I think it's very difficult when it isn't really DHS's fault that we aren't getting the information from the third-party payers. And so we are going to be paying rural health clinics an amount that we aren't sure that we, the state, are actually going to get reimbursed for. So that's why I'm a no until, and this is actually a policy issue, I feel, not necessarily a ways and means decision on that aspect.
Okay, well, I don't know if we have the votes to get this thing out of here.
I think it takes some, I think it needs to have some more discussion here at the policy level to see if there's something. There's really a slip twixt the cup and the lip here. I mean, I understand they want to get paid, but on the other hand, it's going to be added cost and they're only estimating. Okay. Then if at the end of the time they are having to reimburse, let's say they've been overpaid,
yeah,
that would be even more critical because then they may have spent the money.
Okay.
I would like to see more discussion
okay.
of the policy.
Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw my motion. Okay.
So the motion has been withdrawn, and we will close the work session and open a... we're on Senate Bill 39. Mm-hmm. Okay, public hearing, possible work session. Okay, tell us about Senate Bill 39.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 39 was first heard by the committee on January 21st. It dedicates cigarette tax revenues and appropriates money from general fund to the Rural Health Care Revolving Account for Rural Health Safety Net Programs and Services. To the Office of Rural Health, 7% is credited for the purpose of enhancing emergency medical service systems in rural communities. 0.85% is credited to providing rural communities with technical and financial assistance in the development of rural health safety net services. And 2% is credited for rural health viability grants.
Okay. Scott Ekblad.
Senator Morsett, members of the committee, for the record, I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health. Most of what I've had to say about this particular bill I mentioned during the last hearing, but I wanted to make sure that members of the committee received the map that was... During the last hearing, it was mentioned that it would be helpful to see exactly what communities would be assisted through this bill, and so I produced a map, and I didn't ask before the hearing whether it had been distributed. If not, I can give copies. It has? Okay. So we prepared a map in our office of the state of Oregon showing where the rural hospitals are located and where the rural health clinics are located. In particular, a subset of federally certified rural health clinics called isolated rural health facilities. These are the rural health clinics that are located in very small communities where they are the only source of care in that community. So that piece of information, I also wanted to update the committee that I've recently submitted some suggested amendments to the bill. They're really just housekeeping related. One, the bill references a 2001 law where this program was actually approved by the legislature but never funded. At that time, the money was to be directed to the Oregon Rural Health Association rather than the Office of Rural Health, so the amendment makes that correction. The bill is not in agreement with the existing 2001 law. Another is that at the time, the Office of Rural Health from 1999 through 2003 had funding from the Universal Access Fund, I believe it's called, for the EMS grant monies. The statute literally stated that we were not able to use any of the money for administrative costs. Unfortunately, times have changed, and we really don't have the extra funds to implement the program without being able to take some for administrative costs, so that's part of the amendments. That's about it. Otherwise, I'm just here as a resource. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Scott.
Okay. This is not an increase in what's already being paid. This is just the way that the money would be dispensed of the money that's already being paid.
Yeah, it's existing cigarette tax.
Okay. That definitely is a ways
away. You have some suggestions for amendments.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. we have two other individuals, Jennifer Valley and Mike Mullins. Would you come up, please? I think that was a carryover. They signed the wrong sheet.
Are we being punished or did they die?
Okay. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 39, and we will...
Do we have fiscal? No.
Well,
not that I see.
We haven't received fiscal or revenue yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's out of existing cigarette tax. So there's. Okay. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 521.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 521 is scheduled for a work session. This bill adds evaluation, diagnosis, and treatment of subluxation to the definition of chiropractic. This is viewed as a scope of practice bill, and so the reason for this on the agenda is basically for the committee to potentially look at referring this back to the President's office for re-referral.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move that we... refer Senate Bill 548 back to the Senate President's desk for referral to another committee.
Okay. Senator Manus Anderson moves that we...
521. I'm sorry, 521. Yeah,
that we refer Senate Bill 521. We're in work session. 521 to the President's office for... reassignment.
Yes.
Or to do something with.
Yes.
Okay. Discussion? Opposition? Seeing none. So ordered. Senate Bill 548, we will open a public hearing. Nicole, are you signed up to testify? Would you please come up? Senate Bill 548.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 548 requires DHS and area agencies to work collaboratively with stakeholders, advocates, and community partners to develop resources and services to keep seniors and persons with disabilities in their own homes, reducing or avoiding the need for medical assistance in long-term care.
Okay. Kathy Cooper. Nicole.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk about Senate Bill 548. I know that the department will talk a little bit about the process that brought us here to this. During the interim, O4AD, a number of stakeholders, as well as the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities Division, had the opportunity to look at the system thanks to Senate Bill 1061 and some of the needs. And what this bill particularly addresses is some of the work that was done around how to help seniors and people with disabilities work better, to use their own resources better, to stay independent, to lower their dependence on the Medicaid system, to look at prevention, early intervention, and some of those systems and best practices that are used on the national level that could be used here in Oregon. And that's where this bill came into being. As you are aware, there are other bills that are kind of moving around that address some of these topics too. So at some point, Senator, we may be asking you for some amendments to this bill, but we're still kind of waiting to see what happens. There is, of course, a fiscal related to this bill, which of course makes it a bit precarious, but it is an important conversation to have as far as what do we want to be able to do for our seniors and people with disabilities to help them realize as much independence as possible, and also to utilize our state dollars to the very best of our ability, because I think we're seeing in this session more than we've seen in the past few that dollars are scarce, and the way that we choose to use those has to be very thoughtful and considerate in order to make sure that we're getting the best bang for our buck. So okay, with that, I'll turn it over to Kathy.
Thank you.
Kathy?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Cooper. I'm the Deputy Assistant Director for Seniors and People with Disabilities in the Department of Human Services. I am here to discuss with you Senate Bill 548. This bill requires, as Nicole just stated, that the department and our partners, the area agencies on aging, collaborate with a number of stakeholders, our advocates and community partners, to develop a set of resources and services to assist seniors and people with disabilities to remain in their homes and in their home communities, and to remain as independent as possible and not become dependent upon the long-term care system. We have been in a planning process around the long-range plan for Oregon since some of us can remember back to about 2003 when we first engaged in this. In 2005, we were asked through a budget note to do planning, but then it was codified and we were given very specific direction through the supplemental session through Senate Bill 1061 in February, when the supplemental legislative session codified the planning directives to the Department of Human Services around the development of a long-range plan to look at services and supports for individuals that would not be funded through the Medicaid system. We have completed that work, and we put a copy of it in your packet this morning. It identifies on the front page really the support we've had from the campaign for Oregon seniors and people with disabilities, and a number of our partners, our advocates and stakeholders that have spent many, many long hours at the table with us trying to come up with a comprehensive plan that would be acceptable to the state. This plan has been developed. We did also prepare policy option packages that would support a number of the different topics in our long-range plan. Unfortunately, the funding was not included in the governor's recommended budget. We really believe, as Nicole stated, that a comprehensive, easily accessible information really makes better decision makers out of individuals that are faced with decisions about long-term care services. We also have a tremendous amount of evidence that if we use evidence-based practices around prevention and early intervention of services such as chronic disease management, fall prevention, nutrition, Tai Chi, some of the things we're doing in demonstration activities around the state, it really does prevent or delay individuals' access to long-term care services through the Medicaid system. This bill, Senate Bill 548, requires the department, in coordination with our AAA organization, to develop a set of resources and services for seniors and people with disabilities. This also has been accomplished, and there is a copy of that report in your packet, and it looks like this. This bill also requires the department to create and maintain a comprehensive database of services, and it requires us to use up-to-date computer and telephonic technologies. SPD has worked with our partners, and we have presented a comprehensive plan, which we describe as the Aging and Disability Resource Centers. It is a model that has been used nationally. Actually, 47 states in the nation today have what they call Aging and Disability Resource Centers, or one-stop centers that makes information and services easily accessible to any Oregonian. We presented our work and our steering committee's efforts to the Senate Interim Committee on Senior and Disability Services, and also to the House Interim Subcommittee on Seniors and People with Disabilities in June of 2008. A copy of this presentation is before you, and at this time there is no fund source identified either in Senate Bill 548, or it has not been included in the governor's recommended budget. We thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. We'd be glad to answer any questions about the comprehensive plan or about the Aging and Disability Resource Centers that is part of the plan for Oregon.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions?
Yes. Just a comment. I really feel this is so valuable. Part of the constituent calls that I get from districts are saying, please help us find resources to deal with whatever issue that they have regarding the disabled or the elderly. And so it's just tough economic times, but that doesn't mean that if we had the money, we wouldn't want to have this. And I don't know. Hopefully DHS is really looking at what stimulus money we would go along these lines. I have no idea. I think it's primarily focused on economic development, but in a sense this is economic development, because when you have people that have to give up their jobs to care for their elderly parents or they're disabled, they're not able to work. And so I still think that you could make the case that it's an economic development issue.
This bill came as a request of Kay Metzger from Lane County. Kay is not here today, wasn't able to be here. She had some other thoughts about this particular bill as well. So we'll carry this over and hear from Kay at some point. But this is an issue that we need to address. Even without money, communities have to work together to provide information to services, and many communities are doing that. And we had a hearing a week ago Monday where we had
Mr. Chairman
100% access, and what's the name?
Health Matters.
Health Matters come in. Yes, Senator.
Yes, you know, Senator Margaret Carter, co-chair of Ways and Means, and Representative Buckley have made it extremely clear that the budget for the 09-11 for the state of Oregon will not be built on the backs of the vulnerable. Even though this was not in the governor's budget, I think that that discussion will take place in the Ways and Means process with a very strong listening ear from Senator Carter and Representative Buckley. And so I would not discourage you from that. I just wonder if the Ombudsman program also, I have not read your report, so I apologize for that, but I wonder if that wasn't discussed as far as beefing it up in having more assistance through an Ombudsman's program.
Chair Morissette, Senator Berger, I don't believe that we actually specifically talked about the Ombudsman's program, but they are funded through the Older Americans Act fund source, and so they would certainly be a participant and a player at the table as we move forward, and they certainly do a tremendous amount of work in our community facilities today, so we would encourage them to be an equal partner with us.
Mm-hmm.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Right.
Thank you.
How about the RSVP program?
Senator Morissette, RSVP program was also a participant with us in our steering committee and in the development of our plan. And again, I think the difficulty we have is some of these smaller programs, their fund sources continue to be the ones that are targeted when we're looking for...
Now, could you tell us a little bit about the RSVP program?
I can't tell you a lot of specifics, Senator Morissette, just that they're a volunteer, senior volunteer program in a number of our communities, and I believe that they received some federal funds, and they actually have received state general funds over the last several years, and they just help with the coordination of volunteers to do the very activities that you're describing today, where communities help community members to get information and services out to people that are most vulnerable.
I know that last session money was put into that program to keep staff to coordinate volunteers, which is extremely important because if we lose, I guess what I'm concerned about is if we cut too deeply into programs, we'll lose people and lose programs that we may not get back, and that's one of the, I guess maybe the biggest concern in that regard is Project Independence, which basically has been zeroed out from its funding source.
Correct.
And last session, the decision was not to use general fund money, and the source of funding is gone. And if we don't use general fund, the program will disappear completely. And there are some bills to put money into that, which... hopefully we'll go to Ways and Means as for discussion during the final days of this session to see if money is available for Project.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of support for Oregon Project.
Well, there is support. There was support last session, but the money didn't follow the support. And unfortunately, I mean,
it wasn't cut. It was left the same. It just wasn't increased.
Well, the governor's budget, I believe, asked for $16 million. The funding source turned out to be a fund for senior housing deferrals. I believe money was accumulated. Only that money was used to fund Project Independence, and it amounted to $11 million. And now that amount is not there in that particular reserve fund. And so unless there is a decision to go back to the general fund, it was never the intent of the bill that was introduced in 05 that I carried by me that general fund would not be part of Project Independence. So that...
But I think part of that discussion is if you actually have people who leave their homes and go into other kinds of assisted living on state resources, that actually is a bigger burden on the state. And so I think the argument can be made strongly that discussion has to take place as far as impacts. You're going to have to look at both sides of the impact. So,
yeah, I agree. Project Independence is much more cost-effective than Medicaid or treatment in a facility. I mean, keeping people in their own homes. And there is... there's a means test that the AAAs use to determine if a person should pay part of the cost, and sometimes they do pay part or all of the cost if they receive help through Project Independence. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just another, back to the bill. We've been discussing in our other committee all of this stimulus money for databases and, you know, these networks, et cetera, and who knows if there is funding that would help help us with this particular bill. So we want to
make sure that it's a part of the discussion.
I agree, and I think that we will have to wait until the May forecast. We'll have to wait until the decisions or understanding of how stimulus money is used. And I know that Senator Bates, who is the co-chair of the Subcommittee on Human Services, has made the statement several times that there are strings attached to federal dollars that go to programs that need to be funded, which may free up other money. And that's the hope, that there will be some money freed up to take care of something like Project Independence particularly. So,
well, I just think that the governor's budget came with a lot of stress to seniors and people with disabilities. And so I just wouldn't want anyone listening to the hearing today on this bill that seems like it's going to be the way it's going to be, because I don't believe that. I'm a champion for those causes, and if there's any way that I can prevent it from being that way, I think there are many other issues here. We don't have to do it for people that can afford to pay, and I don't think we do that. I think that we do it according to need, but I also think that people live longer, their friends stay with them longer, there's a quality of life there until that day comes when they are forced to do something else and move out of their homes. And there are other reasons. I mean, property taxes, there are other reasons that make people have to make those adjustments. And in the Ways and Means discussion, and I know that Senator Carter is going to be open to this, that we look at those other impacts on seniors' lives that force them to do it, and we need to do it in the most economical way from the state budget position. So,
thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 548, and we are adjourned.
Thank you. Yeah. On that rural health one, I had
Where's
no
the clock?
Idea.
Oh, I, we.